Today we're going to look at some of the unusual features of frontier work. Now, we propose quite categorically that in this field we are frontiersmen. You've just had an example of this in which we are prepared to offer ourselves as guinea pigs and subject ourselves to magnetic fields, believing that if birds, migratory birds, are magnetically sensitive to the Earth's magnetic field, that what birds can be sensitive to, we can be sensitive to as well. But it is all exploratory. The difficulty is that with magnetism, for instance, there has grown up, as it were, a scientific bias against it. The whole field of magnetism is one which is distasteful to the scientists. Nevertheless, we maintain that the human aura is basically a magnetic phenomenon, and that all phenomena, all so-called miracles or miraculous experiences, the ability to be clairaudient or to see the aura, that all these are really basically magnetic phenomena. So we are frontiersmen. Frontiersmen in the field of magnetism, frontiersmen in the field of proposing that there are energy reservoirs in the precincts of our planet which can be channeled into us through meditation. We are frontiersmen in the belief that meditation and other disciplinary exercises like breathing, pranayama, can regenerate nerve tissue in the brain. We are believers also in the matter of the sutures of the brain remaining patent, that the bones can be prevented from setting completely and remain in such a way as to allow the sutures to be patent and for the brain content to be reshaped. I myself am in the process of experimentation in this field. My brain has been x-rayed every 10 years, and I'm due for another x-ray almost immediately to observe whether there are any changes in the x-ray patterns of my brain. All of our heads tend to grow a little as we get older, but whether heads have grown quite as fast as mine has grown is another point. That there are psychological factors involved here. With a swollen head, of course, one must take risks on that. But I merely point out here that we are frontiersmen. We don't pretend to know or to explain the facts of nature, the realities of existence, but it is our work to remain ahead of science. That's what esoteric sciences are for, to remain ahead of science. Now, all over the place, science is catching up. Orthodox science is catching up with esoteric teachings, and we are ready to make a new expansion, a new exploration, promised for the end of every century. And here we're coming into the last 20 years of the century, and it's been promised that this exploration would be done. And you're going to share in it. As much as you can give of yourself, decide how much you will share in that exploration. Already, occult chemistry, the observation of the nuclei of atoms by C.W. Leadbeater and Annie Besant, this work is already being shown to be valid in terms of the discovery of quarks by the scientific world, subatomic particles of the nature of quarks which correspond in many ways to the combinations of Anu as perceived clairvoyantly by Leadbeater. Today I want to go into the field of pregnancy, into the field of embryology and reaffirm some of the ancient teachings on the period of pregnancy and the growth of the human embryo. It's a period of great importance, we maintain, because you are observing in pregnancy the growth of a human organism from a tiny, watery, fertilized cell, 1/200th of an inch in diameter, just visible to the naked eye. You observe it grow in 9 months into a human organism with bones, cartilage, nails, teeth, and many other solid features. And a creature that has tremendous potential. The potential of the child, the baby, to change into an Einstein or a Newton, an Isaac Newton. But there is a higher relationship here. There's a higher relationship. And we say that we ourselves are spiritual embryos. We are growing towards a stage of spiritual rebirth. And that the embryo merely acts out the spiritual destiny of man. And just as the embryo is born, goes through the birth canal, and under tremendous stress, strain, forces its way through the birth canal, we do the same in discipleship, spiritual unfoldment. We have to present ourselves to the gates of initiation, the spiritual equivalent of the birth canal. So in studying and observing the embryo, we can learn much about our own spiritual destinies. By that I mean mankind as a whole. And one of the things that we are concerned with today is the impact of the pregnant mother on her child, on her developing fetus. Because we ourselves are impacted upon in the sensitive stage of discipleship, of spiritual unfoldment, we are impacted by our mother, by our Father in heaven, by our higher self. And we ourselves become extraordinarily sensitive. We talk about Mother Church if we're Catholics. We talk about the anima mundi of the earth if we're occultists. We talk about Father, Son, and Holy Ghost as Christians, or Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma if we are Hindus, and so on. We throw ourselves open. We accept the fact that without nourishment from our spiritual Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, we cannot grow out of our stage of embryonic development. So there is this very important correlation. Madame Blavatsky said, the terrestrial embryo contains within it the future man with all his potentialities. It is also the hyper-spiritual prism in which the human embryo develops from a scientific point of view. We just do not understand how a tiny watery cell, 1/200th of an inch in diameter, a little bag of protoplasm, is able to develop into the human fetus. We cannot understand the way in which its cells multiply and eventually produce the gristle or cartilage
of the skeleton, as well as its bony portions. It's very easy to put this all down to the activity of enzymes and hormones. But if we were to add up all the enzymes and hormones required to fashion the human baby out of a watery cell of protoplasm, we would need a commencing egg, fertilized egg, which would be in diameter about the size of a 5p piece. And so we must look elsewhere for explanations as to how the genes and chromosomes inside the nucleus of the initial egg are coaxed into action at certain very important times. When you observe an embryo, there are certain amazing things about it in its development. One of the amazing things is that it's in the process of materializing. The growth of an embryo is the materializing of a form. The initial cells don't show up on X-ray, but eventually the bones and cartilage do, and eventually we have a materialized form, which is not complete even at birth, but continues to ossify and densify its bones right up until the age of 22. And so we're looking, if we had the X-ray pictures, at a long consecutive range of photographs showing an object materializing. Now, the correlation to the phenomenon of materialization, which happens in the seance room, is obvious here. You should refer to the book on materialization, which I have recently written, and the photographs there, of course. We don't also understand phenomena regarding the embryo very well as regards the maturation of its nervous system. What matures the nervous system of a child, of the embryo? What is maturation? If blood is to be taken from a newborn baby, or even a baby 2 or 3 weeks old, you can watch the surgeon plunge his scalpel into the foot of the child doesn't feel it. It barely feels it. What matures the nervous system of the child so that it eventually can control its bowels? So that it can think for itself, so that it can identify itself as something separate from its parents. And then there's this matter of demonstrating in its growth the whole history of our planet. The embryo goes through the different stages of life, mimics the different stages of life as we regard it developing under the Darwinian theory. What sort of mechanisms lie behind this? Our proposition is that from the very moment of conception, there is an etheric force field around that fertilized egg. And that force field provides subjective energies to the genes and chromosomes that are beginning to be released, or their coded information beginning to activate tissue development. We say also there is an astral sheath elaborated out of astral permanent atoms hovering over the embryo, affecting its etheric matrix. And we say, of course, there is a mental sheath as well. We also say that there is the additional factor of an overshadowing soul. Unlike animals, each human fetus
has a link with a higher self, which makes it quite distinct from all layers of lower organisms. I should say organisms of lower kingdoms. Now this period of growth in 9 months means that the child is very, very receptive to what is going on in its mother. What the mother is thinking affects the mental sheath of the child. What the mother is feeling affects the astral sheath of the growing embryo. What the mother is eating and drinking, whether she is smoking, also affects the physical development of the embryo. Now these factors have been taught for generations, but only in recent years has science come out and discovered that this is true, that the period of pregnancy is incredibly sensitive, and very special attention must be paid to the diet of the mother. Let us take an instance of this. A few nights ago, you would have seen in Tomorrow's World a program in which it has been demonstrated recently that the condition of spina bifida is related to the pregnancy of the mother. We used to think, or medical science used to think, that this was a congenital condition. It was tied up with chromosomes and genes, a condition in which the spinal column doesn't close properly. And so a great space is left open where the tissues that should wrap the spinal cord up completely remain open in a great gap, hence the word spina bifida. But it has been discovered now that the condition is intimately related to diet, the mother's diet. Japanese, you eat a good solid diet of fish and rice, have almost no incidence of spina bifida at all. When we come to the English and the Scots, we find that the incidence is very high indeed of spina bifida. And when we go to the Northern Ireland people, the Northern Irish, we find the highest incidence in the world of spina bifida. Now, of course, it's been discovered that when women in pregnancy are given vitamins, adequate vitamins, the incidence of spina bifida drops very, very dramatically. But we have taught for centuries that the diet of the mother is important, that she should not only be given enough sustenance for two right from the beginning of the pregnancy, for two people, that's a very old teaching indeed, but it has been taught that the whims of the pregnant woman should be taken into account as well. And providing these are not destructive, as they might sometimes be, that those whims should be met. And they are notorious, pregnant women are, notorious for their period of strange tastes that they develop. We say that this goes on not only in the easily recognizable field of sensory perception through taste, but it goes on in the other senses and also spiritually as well. And so there is a period during pregnancy in which the mother should be given harmonious conditions. The sciences of the future will take this into account. Color will be used. It was said in ancient days that the parent or the mother should not be subjected to any horrific experience.
that this could in some way be imprinted on the child. Well, we didn't mean specifically the nature of the experience is apt to affect the child, but that can cause upsets in the child. There are said to be ugly parents who have had the most beautiful children. We have even instances in which a very plain mother and an even plainer father have set out by visualizing a beautiful child right from the beginning, that they have given birth to a very beautiful child. Now, we don't know how these mechanisms work. We don't say that we can describe them in terms of atoms and molecules, in terms of light, heat, and magnetism, and in terms of enzymes and genes and chromosomes. But we do say that these factors are there, and we should take them into account. Old wives' tales? Well, we're not finding that that is so true as it used to be thought. To find out if a woman was pregnant, often the urine of the woman was poured onto wheat grains. And if the wheat grains sprouted, then this was an indication that the woman was pregnant. That was an old pregnancy test. An old wives' tale? We used to think so. But now we know that certain hormones excreted only by pregnant women have an effect on the germination process of grains of wheat. And so the hormones in the pregnant woman cause the grain to sprout, whereas normally it would be unaffected by the urine. Old wives' tales? We don't agree. We believe that there is information here of great importance. Now, how does all this affect us? It means that our teachings say quite clearly we must evolve new methods of caring for women in the prenatal stages. Why should we bother about this so much? The truth is that there are, as we repeat again and again, there are Buddhas galore awaiting rebirth, that they are excluded from rebirth because of the inability of mankind to produce yet sufficiently refined vehicles for these Buddhas. A little earlier I talked about 3 people in 10,000 being physically perfect. But what about the etheric sheaths of such individuals, the mental and emotional natures of them? We say that if this period, this antenatal care of the mother and the growing fetus is taken into account, and that certain recommendations are implemented, that vehicles will be produced which will enable highly developed souls, very spiritual individuals, to come into incarnation. There is a quickening even now on the frontier of the New Age. I lecture very frequently, as you know, up and down the country. It is surprising always to me that complete strangers to the field of esoteric science can come along to a meeting and be lit up in a few minutes of hearing the talk. Somebody came to a meeting the other night in Hartford, and he said, "I've only come because my girlfriend can't get here, and she wants me to make a note of some of the information of the talk which you're giving tonight. She is keen on it. I've never heard anything about the subject before." He ended up by buying 6 books for himself. He was so switched on, and he had never heard the subject mentioned before. And it is an age in which this is going to increase, and we must be ready for it. And so we say then that the period before birth, the period before the child goes through the birth canal, corresponds greatly to ourselves
in our spiritual unfoldment. Was it Michael Faraday who was the discoverer of electromagnetism? And he began to demonstrate that you could rotate a coil in a magnetic field and produce electricity. The great flashes that made the demonstration so dramatic. And people saw it and they couldn't understand what he was getting at. What are you getting at? What's the point of this electricity and this electromagnetism? What purpose can it possibly have? And he had to say to them, what is the purpose of a newborn baby? What is its potential? The child will die in a few hours if it's left alone. If it is not nurtured and cultured and cultivated, then it has the potential of an Isaac Newton. Today, of course, we live with electromagnetism. We have devices all around us. Only when the electricity is cut off for 3 or 4 hours do we find ourselves helpless. We flop around in the kitchen and we switch the kettle on and say, well, I'll have a cup of tea just to soothe my nerves while the electricity comes on again. And of course, the kettle doesn't heat up. And then you're going to sit in front of the telly and expect it to come on waiting. And it doesn't come on. And then we realize what electromagnetism has become. The potential which was all that it was in the hands of an inventor, Michael Faraday. What is the point of an ashram? What is the point of an ashram?
To create those conditions under which...
That's right. To create conditions whereby spiritual embryos can grow. And it's only when you leave an ashram that you find how damn difficult it is in the outer world for an embryo, a spiritual embryo, to grow. So there are many, many relationships between the two processes. Would it be a good thing if the baby's skull could form completely before it's born? No, it wouldn't. The baby's skull has to alter its shape as it goes through the birth canal. And if the birth canal is very narrow because the mother is tiny, she's petite, the father may be immense. And so the struggle of that baby through the birth canal may be very difficult indeed. And it can go through the birth canal because its fontanelles are not closed. And the top of its head is like the petals of a flower. They can even overlap each other and get through the canal. Then they can set. And so there are many things in the embryo which have a likeness to us as persons on the path. We talk about malleability. Malleability. You're no damn good. You come into the spiritual path with fixed ideas. You may as well leave immediately. Those fixed ideas are swept away. Have to be swept away. Preconceived morals, preconceived judgments, ideas, foques, mores, whatever you like to call them. The kind of religion we've grown up with, what we were taught at school, these things must not act as concretized structures, or you cannot be reborn, you cannot go through the birth canal. Is the regeneration of memory. It is so universally applicable that one must regard it as a signpost on the path of spiritual unfoldment. And you should strongly suspect some of your methods if you find that your memory does not improve. It means that something is going wrong somewhere. Not necessarily going wrong, but you are not undertaking some of the disciplines in a correct fashion. We always emphasize that memory is something which is quite perfect in its availability of man, so long as we can break out of the ordinary confines of thinking merely in lower mentality. By that we mean with active intelligence. It's best illustrated this matter by considering the straightforward units of nervous conduction, which we call the neuron. The neuron is a cell, it's a nerve cell, which is responsible for, in large numbers, for making up the ganglia, which we call the nervous system. Now, we maintain that each neuron has, of course, an etheric counterpart to it. Every single atom or molecule comprised in the neuron has its etheric counterpart. We maintain also that, loosely fitting, this is the emotional or astral counterpart. And finally, even more loosely fitting, is the mental counterpart. And so, although we may not ever be able to trace in actual physical neurons the memory banks of the brain, we maintain that the memory banks nevertheless exist in their etheric, emotional, and mental counterparts of the neurons. Now, we all know, of course, that the way in which memory is stored is strongly related to our ideas, our images, and the external that we gain from the world. The way in which we pack things into our memory banks is mainly through association. So, somewhere in the memory banks, there is a place for the color red as we see it. There's a place close to it for the word red. And there's a place for hearing the word red, and so on. These associated areas produce a sort of center in the memory banks. Now, these memory banks vary in accordance to certain matters, certain factors in their efficiency. Some parts of the memory banks are very efficient indeed, and especially those parts that are related to the four psychological drives. We talk about the desire for security, the desire for new experience, the desire for recognition in the world, and the desire for response. And these energies pouring out of the astral world through our, mainly our solar plexus chakra, give our personalities the kind of impetus that makes them effective. These four desires, for that's what they are, or psychological drives, therefore have a lot to do with the functioning of our interpenetrating bodies. We say that also, that where a drive is related to memory banks which have externa associated with that drive, let us say it's the desire for response, a sort of sexual drive, if that drive is exerted powerfully, it tends to light up those regions of the memory banks which have externa objects, associations with the expression of sex or response. And a person who is really with it is a person able to exert his drives, his forces. If he is not or couldn't care less about recognition, then the energy drive for recognition will not light up those parts of the astral memory banks and their etheric counterparts associated with the desire for recognition. So memory in those areas will be somewhat dulled. So the average personality has his drives, and these are very important. We say that the young soul will progress around the zodiac and his patterns of lives very rapidly with the assistance of energies from the astral world, the desire energies which show up in his drives. We encourage this. We believe that young souls should express their desires very potently. However, as the soul matures with hundreds of lives on the earth, we say that the energy of desire should not be so powerful. There should not be this constant desire for recognition or for new experience and so on. And in fact, what we encourage, rather, is the input of motive, the input of motive. And the input of motive is made more specific by our calling this right motive, right motive. And so rather than allowing the drives to dominate everything in the personality, we begin to orientate ourselves to the soul, to the higher self, and to allow our actions in the world to be dominated by right motive. The effect of this is that our emotional drives begin to wane, and we therefore very quickly gain control of the emotional body, because it is no longer as explosive as it was. We begin to gain control of the emotional nature, and by substituting right motive for these basic drives, primitive drives, we begin to activate our deepest, most refined memory banks. And so, in the memory banks, in higher mental matter, what we call higher manas, in the memory banks associated with buddhi, and the memory banks associated with atma, in these memory banks, there are stirred into waking consciousness the various elements stored there. And right motive then begins to convey energies which bring us knowledge of previous lives, awareness of qualities of those lives, and at the same time, the energies of motive, right motive, also activate in general the memory banks in mental, astral, and etheric substance. And so the memory of the individual becomes improved. We don't mean that this individual can now go in and win mastermind or something like that. We mean that with due understanding of the deep processes involved, such as I've described here, the replacement of emotional drives with right motive, energies of right motive, which come from deep divine levels. These refined energies activate memory banks, and they take time to operate. So when we try to stir the memory, try to remember something, don't expect it to come back to you immediately. Posit it, just as if you were adopting the Claregate method. Proposition the higher self what it is you want to remember. I was doing the soul's purpose the other night of somebody, and I had been propositioning the aspect from the soul involving the Earth and Mars. Neptune was involved as well, and all sorts of visual images coming back, which I recorded. I had put my pen down and was relaxing for a moment, and suddenly there came through the words, Volrod Voltamard. Now, that's an unusual name, very unusual name, which I hadn't used, certainly, for the last 25 years. But it is a name from South Africa of a famous Dutch hero who had been riding along the seashore in the Cape Province one day during rough weather, and he had heard cries for help coming from the sea, and he saw a great galleon on the rocks. And the men were trapped on board, and the ship was breaking up. And no one to save them. This youngster turned his horse into the waves and swam out. The horse swam out to the ship, and he brought back two or three men each time to the seashore. And he did this several times, but each time he got back to the ship had broken up further, and eventually the men all jumped at the horse, and they all drowned. And he was a famous hero. But that name just came out of the unconscious while I was fully awake, fully aware. And it's the kind of glorious memory associations that can surface once you begin to alert this whole region. The region, of course, is the three head centers, Ajna, the brow center, Sahasrara, the thousand-petaled lotus, and Alta Major. And when these three head centers are energized, their refined emission brings into action the memory banks in a synthetic way, a synthesis, not just flashes of memory that can pester you and under ordinary personality circumstances, but under special conditions, releases of memories can be an everyday thing. And right motive is the basis of many great religions, especially Buddhism, where the actions are not considered nearly so important as the underlying motivation. And if you get the motives right, and you practice right motive, it is an easy way, an easier way for some certainly, to undertake the spiritual disciplines. Feel that if they know what they're doing, and right motive is a very obvious thing, they practice right motive, they get very good results. However, there is very little written on the analysis of what right motive is. How do we judge right motive? Do we judge it in terms of the law of the land? What the law says we should think? Or how we should act? Do we judge it according to nature? In which case we would very frequently offend man-made laws. Or do we act on some other origin? I can only, in the space of time available to me, give you another method of remembering how to arrive at right motive. I'm going to list the kind of factors that you should bear in mind as being the substance of right motive. And there are five of them, five spiritual motives. And these five spiritual motives should qualify, should amplify, and should modify your personality behavior, your thought, your word, your deed should be affected by these five spiritual motives. The first is the aesthetic. Your motivation should be affected by an inner impulse to express the aesthetic. Now, if you don't know what the aesthetic is, you should make a private study of it. I'm always saying to you, don't just study haphazardly. Get hold of a folder and put down the word "the aesthetic" on the folder. And as you do your studies, your reading, your meditation, so on, feed the folder with information about the nature of what is aesthetic, what is its relationship to the beautiful, to the good, and so on. So that eventually, when you give a talk, as you will be expected to, as part of the curriculum, you might decide that you have such a nice bulky folder on right motive, especially with regard to aestheticism, that you could give a 10 or 15 minute talk on the aesthetic aspect of right motive. So, Becky, I'm going to ask you on any arm of the five-pointed star on the board to write in the word aesthetic, A-E-S-T-H-E-T-I-C, aesthetic. We talk about aesthetes in the world, people who are aesthetes, who like to appreciate the deeper meaning of things that are beautiful and artistic. But you should make an analysis of it for yourselves. Later we will give the esoteric significance of aestheticism. The second arm of the five-pointed star reflects the soul's intent in the world, the soul's motives, is that what you do in the world should be motivated by humanitarianism. Humanitarianism. Does my action take into account, consider, humanity as a whole, individually, groups, community, and so on? Thirdly, is my motivation ethical? Does it conform to what is ethical? It's no good being aesthetic, having every consideration for humanity, and then being non-ethical. And fourthly, is it altruistic? Is it altruistic? I remember Hans Selye, the great endocrinologist who studied the endocrine cells of man very intently and observed the function that they played in the body. Somebody said to him, "You've studied endocrine cells which produce the hormones very carefully. If they were human beings, if these cells were human beings, what qualities would the human being have if they were to be successful as endocrine cells?" May seem a ridiculous question, but there you are. And Selye said, I would expect the cells, by that he implied all the cells of the body, to express an altruistic egotism, an altruistic egotism. And we make no bones about it in the West. We don't say that our yoga, the path of synthesis, the path of psychosynthesis, I should say, should be one of complete humiliation and negativity, such as is most acceptable to some Oriental minds, but rather one in which you assert the personality, but in a way that is egotistical and yet considerative of altruism. In other words, I'll run my business efficiently for mankind. I will do this or that and sound my note in the world so that I can be a better person in my service to mankind. So altruism. And then fifthly, the heroic, the attitude which is one of heroism. We don't have to sit and watch television for very long or sit behind the steering wheels in our cars for very long before we see examples of heroism. All of us are thinking at the moment of a woman getting out from under the ice in the Potomac River from a plane, one of only five people to get out of their seat belts and free, coming to the surface, hundreds of people watching. Oh God, there's a human being there, struggling in waters that are freezing, fighting for her life. And then we saw somebody who could easily have been amongst all the others watching, saying the same thing. But no doubt he was not going to stand there and watch. He was going to jump in and do what he could, even if he lost his own life. And that is what he did. And we were thrilled by it. So you need to look into these things. Heroism. Who is the hero? What is a hero? What constitutes a hero? I remember when I was a little boy reading, was it Carlyle on hero and hero worship? Anybody know? Look it up. Hero and hero worship. So if you're going to say to yourself, well, what constitutes right motive? Can I really trust that the highest motivation within me is unsullied by my personality drives? That's why I gave you that drawing. And think about the five-pointed star, which is a symbol that we use not only for the human soul, but for the symbol of hierarchy. The hierarchy of 60 masters on the planet, as they represent the motivation, right motivation of humanity, as compared to the drives of humanity. Think of the five-pointed star. Perhaps you can work out even a mnemonic, like we say, chrome, for the qualities for discipleship. Perhaps you can work out a mnemonic. I think I worked one out for that lot, and it came out as Ahi, which is one of the sacred words, one of the sacred words. Oyoho, another sacred word. However you do it is up to you. But motive is very important. And as right motive begins to function more and more in your life, it begins to feed energies into the three head centers concurrently. It begins to synthesize the personality around a point of higher consciousness. And instead of you worrying about the old method of transmutation of energies, sublimation of energies from the sacral center to the throat and from the throat to outer major, from the base of the spine to the head, think in terms of just expressing right motive in the world. Might be easier for you. And it is out of the release of such divine energies that memory banks begin to function in a way that is quite inexplicable.